Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Stephen the Warman Rice Kickfighting Podcast Show. I'm your host, Stephen the Warman. You are listening to my podcast in one of two ways. Either you are at the blog, which is lordgaul.podbean.com. Lord Gaul was the name that I used when I first got into kickboxing. It was my username on Kakutugi, K1 Fans, K1 USA, and so on. And then you are also, the most efficient way is to enter Warman Kickfighting Show or enter Lord Gaul into the iTunes search engine. That way, it'll just pop up on a regular basis, just like all the other podcast that you listen to. You can also find me on Twitter at Stephen the Warman, one word. Joined by the two guys that I try to bring in for every Glory event, and they've been consistent, so it's been absolutely wonderful because it's always fun when I can kick this back and forth between two people. First, we're going to go ahead and go to Mr. Liverkick himself, Dave Walsh. Say what's up to the people and tell them how they can find you on Twitter.
On the internet machines. Yeah. Yes, I run Liverkick. It's a place to read about kickboxing, and I'm the only sap in the world that is willing to do this instead of the lucrative seas of mixed martial arts anymore. So it's liverkick.com. You can find me on the Twitter bot at Liverkick, D-O-T-C-O-M. And I got a personal one at D-V-E-W-L-S-H where I talk about all the things I do that aren't combat sports related, and none of you care about that.
Cool. Well, we are also joined by Patrick Wyman of Sheerdog.com, who's on the lucrative end.
Yeah.
What's up?
I'm on some end of it. I still have yet to find that lucrative end. We're still working on getting there. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman.
Cool. Well, before we get started, before we get into our Glory breakdown, definitely want to give a spot to allow Dave Walsh to sell his book. Dave Walsh, this is the second book that he's put out, and he self-published them both, if I'm correct. Godslayer was the first one. Give us a little rundown of your second book so that people can watch it, your venture into the sci-fi world.
Yeah, I made a very conscious decision to, write something that's a little bit more commercially viable. I don't think a lot of people are interested in reading about fictionalized fighting. The last book actually did pretty well. But anyway, I launched a science fiction series a week ago now. Yeah, a week and a day. First book was Terminus Cycle. It's all of the kind of, really nihilistic kind of things you'd expect from me and more. And that's, I actually think it's pretty. So come on. I mean, I hate everything I do and I like it. You can find it on Amazon for both Kindle and paperback. I caved with the paperback thing because you people don't like technology, apparently.
Not readers.
It's true. I don't get it personally. I've owned like 6 Kindles. I don't know, but that's, hey, more power to people if they want to spend an extra $10. And cool. There's been a bunch of people who have spent the extra $10, so cool for them.
Cool. Well, we'll go ahead and jump right into the action. We're going to talk Glory today, the breakdown of the Glory card that's happening in Dubai. Before we get started, first things first, before we even break down the card, I'll go ahead and start with you, Dave. But what are your thoughts on them going to Dubai? Dubai is a place that I was there last year for an MMA event when my heavyweight, Jerry Rochal, he won on a UFC card out in Dubai. It was actually in Abu Dhabi, but Dubai is about 45 minutes away. The reason why I bring up Dubai is, first of all, they got a lot of money in Dubai. People have no idea until you're there, but you literally will watch 10 Ferraris and Lamborghinis drive by you. So they got a lot of money like there. But also the community of people, they love having events there. So they're going to go out, and it doesn't even necessarily need to be the most prestigious event. This card in particular, it's weird because the first thing you think of, if you're thinking of a Glory event in Dubai, it's like a no-brainer. Got to use Badahari, got to use Gokhan Saki, got to use one of these two guys in that area. Because of the contract dispute, and I think both sides have good arguments in it, they weren't able to pull that off, but they still put together a really good card. I think Mustafa Mirani's style will be loved by the crowd. But just all in all, what are your views on them going to Dubai, and what are you expecting crowd-wise?
I'm not expecting much, to be honest with you. I mean, while the people that actually live in Dubai like having this prestige of the events and stuff like that, like, Dubai is kind of this weird place that, from what I understand, like, while it's super rich, there's also a large part of it that's just like abandoned development and, like, people kind of gave up on it. Like, you know, the Western world, Westerners that went over there, and then our markets all got all screwed up in 2009 or whatever, and they kind of haven't gone back. So it's kind of, to me, it just feels like a place that doesn't self-sustain. I'm not sure. It kind of feels like a prestige event more than it does, like, trying to build up a market somewhere. Like, I don't feel like Dubai really embodies, like, the whole, like, Middle Eastern area. Like, that's not the common people out there.
For sure.
I think it might be good to get some investors on board out there. As you said, there's money. I mean, like, you see those GFC events, which actually, you know, that's a couple weeks away with Saki on it, which is the confusing part for a lot of people. But, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, you know, their local draws that they're using are basically Moroccans, which is, why not just run Morocco? Like, if their main, like, draw was, like, you know, like, Pat Barry dropped out, which was their big U.S. draw for the show, and then they kept Bouzidi on the main card, and it's like, okay, cool, I guess. Like, yeah, I mean, I think that it'll do fine. I think you're going to have a lot of comp tickets and that kind of stuff, but they're never really making money off of ticket sales anyway. So it's just, it just seems like a strange place for them to go to unless you're courting an investor directly, which they might be doing.
For sure.
Yeah. I mean, I also wouldn't be surprised if they were just straight up getting paid by you know, whether it's a particular sports ministry or some private investor who wants to have it there. I mean, that would not at all surprise me if there were just a straight up cash transfer to Glory in return for holding an event there. Like, that's definitely happened before in this part of the world. Yeah, I mean, I gotta echo a lot of that. I don't think there's exactly, like, a huge fan base for kickboxing, like, per se, in Dubai, just like I don't know that there's a huge fan base for anything in Dubai, because who actually lives in Dubai? I mean, it's like, everything I've heard from people who have been there and have spent time there is that it's just an incredibly weird place on a wide variety of levels. Yeah, I mean, it would make me a little uncomfortable, but you know, I think it's not the worst case scenario. It's a really good card. There's a lot to like about the card. A lot of strange choices in terms of matchmaking, though. I mean, I think the undercard is weird. I don't know that there's any other way to put it.
There's not.
Yeah, you know, it's weird for me because one thing that I really wanted to, like, focus on, you know, whenever we talk about kickboxing, it's just, I will always think about its future. You know, now that K1's gone, I will never ever be satisfied with, oh, this is a good card today. I always want to know where they're going or what they're trying to do with something. When I see some of the crowds that they have for, you know, Conor McGregor in Ireland, and I was watching boxing the other day, and I saw the big, you know, the huge draw that they had for, you know, which was pretty much, I mean, a mandatory boxing match or whatever, there was a huge community of people that came out and watched it and supported it. I definitely think that that kickboxing has those places in the world, and I'm waiting for Glory to commit to those places. You don't necessarily have to do it forever, but maybe once, twice a year. Like, the Morocco thing is such a no-brainer for me. You know, like it's just, you've got so many elite-level Moroccan fighters. You could pretty much do it like how the UFC does their Brazilian cards, and everybody would just love it. You know, like you would just, it'd be a good one with, this is the scene, this is the thing that, because it's the one thing that we haven't been able to get back since, you know, Japan, you know, has gone away, is we haven't been able to kind of provide that. It's so special to be part of this kickboxing community, you know, when you watch some of those old K1 events or whatever. And I think the crowd is a big part of that. And the action, the product of kickboxing will always sell itself. It will always be entertaining because there's always going to be good elite-level fighters coming around the corner. There's always going to be new talent. The struggle is when it's not sustained, people can't make money in it, and they start thinking, well, maybe I need to go to something else. You know, maybe I need to go to boxing. Shane Campbell, I just got signed by the UFC today, I saw. And that guy was a...
He did?
Yeah, he's going to fight short notice, I want to say McDessie.
Yeah.
So, like, we're talking about a guy who was a... I wrote for World Muay Thai magazine, like, 6 years ago now, and one of the stories that I wrote was how I felt he was the best North American Muay Thai fighter, and that was, like, you know, 6 years ago. He, you know, continued to do it, continued to wait for his opportunity to possibly fight in K1, It didn't end up happening. Then K1, you know, went through some transitions. And then the newer version of K1, his old trainer, Allen, became one of the main guys involved with, you know, matchmaking and so on. And that got him a couple opportunities, but nothing consistent. So then he started fooling around with MMA here and there, put together a couple, you know, good wins, got a win on World Series of Fighting where he did the, you know, the fireball thing that he likes to do. And next thing you know, the opportunity comes from being, you know, the highest level mixed martial arts. And he took it. And this is a guy who I very much believe would have been a career kickboxer if the opportunities were there.
That's crazy. I'm not even joking. I emailed a couple higher ups of Glory like a month ago, like right after the Hedekin thing happened.
Oh yeah.
I was like, you need to hire this guy now. Oh. He's been doing this for so long. He's so good. I mean, he's one of the few guys that like wins consistently with like using that weird digging toe kick thing that he does.
For sure.
And I'm like, he's exciting and he's good at this, and you should probably look into him. And they're like, eh. It's like, okay, all right. He signed for the UFC.
Yeah, and his story, there's a long list of stories like that. Like, for example, here's the most popular one, Cowboy Cerrone. Cerrone went out to the K1, when I do the American version of the documentary, I'm really hoping that I can get some of the footage that they had from the first K1 tryout. I can't tell you enough how many elite level guys that we had that are now famous mixed martial artists who started off in that room, put on a show, and K1 didn't commit to any of these guys. And Cerrone was one of those guys. He was 26-0-1 as a kickboxer. And then he was in another fight afterwards. The guy's last name was Lamont. I can't remember his first name. But he had another kickboxing match, and that was supposed to be the match that got him into K1 on a regular. They didn't use him one time. They continued to go with the same crop of guys that they had. And he started taking mixed martial arts fights. Next thing you know, they led to him getting into WEC led into UFC, and then the rest is history. There are guys who started off with the dream of kickboxing and it just didn't turn into anything. So that's kind of always going to be my fear for this sport. And this card has got some talented guys, some guys that are a little bit on the stranger end. But like, I believe the kickboxing product will always sell itself. But if guys don't feel like they've got a home in it, that's going to be it. That's going to be difficulty. So we're going to go ahead and jump into the first fight on the card that I want to break up. I'm going to go from the top down, or excuse me, from the bottom up. We're going to go with Anatoly Moiseev against Max Bermont. And now I'm going to go ahead and open by jealously talking about how excited I am about Anatoly Moiseev fighting in Glory. This dude is awesome. Like, for people who don't know, if I just recommended one fight to you, go watch the fight where he fights the Israeli fighter Itay Gershon, Itaygershon, versus Anatoly, Anato, sometimes it's pronounced L-I-Y at the end instead of L-Y, against Moiseev, Moiseev. Go watch that fight. It literally happened, you know, in February, so not that long ago at all. But this guy is one of the best catch-counter guys in kickboxing. He will literally move in a way where he can catch and he fires back so smooth and quick. He's got good power and he is a spinning back kick machine. Like, he's going to try it all the time. And he's got really good timing on it and he's going to put together good offense. But the biggest thing is his ability to bite down, take your offense, and deliver fast counters. Max Bermont is still a talented guy. Jauncey really kind of brought it to him in his last fight, and he kind of struggles to keep up with the higher pace of guys who've got really good kickboxing flow. This fight ain't doing him any favors. I really think Moiseev is going to, you know, really kind of introduce himself to the world in this fight. I think he's a very talented guy. He pretty much was groomed in the TATNF. For people who aren't familiar with how TATNF worked, it's strange to get a handle of those guys, because in TATNF, you've got three rounds, and if you score down, then you can win the fight in three rounds. If you don't, no matter what happened in the action, they will automatically go to an extra round, which is ridiculous. So you could literally win the first three rounds. They'll call it a draw no matter what, because there was no down in the round, and then you go to the extra. And the fight with Gershon that I mentioned, Gershon was actually deducted a point, and they still go to the extra round. Doesn't matter. It's just more awesome action. So I'm definitely going to start off with, I got Moiseev beating, and it's not an upset to me, Max Bermont. Even though Bermont is still a talented kid, I still think that he's going to be a serviceable guy, but this is the level of fighting that I think he stays at. So that is Anatoly Moiseev over Max Bermont, and then I will go ahead and start with Pat. Pat, who you got in the first one?
I also like Moiseev in this one. I'm glad you mentioned his counter. I mean, his countering ability, because like if you throw a front kick at a front kick or a teep at Moiseev, you're taking your life in your hands because mm-hmm. he's going to catch it and he's going to come back with like three or four punches and a kick on the end of it. I mean, just vicious, hard. He's a really good athlete. He's really fast. Mm-hmm. Got a lot of pop in his shots. I'm a big fan of Bomert as well, but I think this is a bad matchup for him in terms of a guy who can push a pace on him, who's creative, who's going to do some interesting things. I think that's hard for a guy like Bomert to deal with, who doesn't have like what I would call like elite athleticism or even plus athleticism. I think that's going to be hard for him to deal with. So I too like Moiseev. I don't think that he finishes Bomert, but I like him to take a fairly comfortable decision.
Cool, Dave Walsh.
Yeah, I'm leaning towards Moiseev as well. One thing that I really noticed about him when watching his fights is that he other than that spinning kick, he really has this kind of thing where he likes using in a place that doesn't really make sense for it to be, he'll use a left hook. And it's just like, you know, his opponent will be doing something and he'll just like go for a jab and then immediately follow up with the left hook and totally catch him off guard. And it's just like, he does little things like that that a lot of other guys just don't do. And that's the kind of stuff that's going to make him possibly a star. I mean, if he keeps with this and, you know, I think that Bomert's fine. Not even plus athleticism. Ouch. But, I kind of agree with that. He's pretty skilled at what he does, but he just doesn't have that little bit extra to push him into this level, and I think we're going to see that here.
For sure. So definitely three in favor of Moiseev. And again, it's nothing against Bomert. It's just literally, it's when you can see something like a star rising, when you can see that kind of ability and that kind of fight style. And if you watch the Tatnev fights, or if you watch some of the fights in Russia, Moiseev is a draw. Like, people are chanting his name, the crowd is into him. He's one of those guys where I'm telling you, if they Glory going to Russia would be a big deal. And the last time they went to Russia, I thought they put on a pretty good show, and that was with, you know, Kertanov as the, you know, main draw. So a young up-and-coming star like this is going to be huge. So definitely I'm excited to see this bout. Next fight on the card I'm going to talk about is the welterweight bout between Atakan Arslan as he takes on Chad Sugden. And first of all, Chad Sugden, if you've ever seen this guy fight before, you know, he's got one of the strangest styles in kickboxing that you will ever see in your life. He literally moves and evades shots like a boxer. But I'm telling you, he's doing it in slow motion. They're not sharp, fast twitch motions. He slowly gets out of the way of everything, and he finds, you know, moments to pop little sneaky shots in, and it's weird because style-wise, he does work – I mean, he works out well against attacking Arslan, because Arslan is a guy who he spends a lot of time in Thailand, training with Tiger Muay Thai. I mean, there's some benefits to that, and there's some fault – I mean, there's some problems with it, because some of the level of competition that you go against on Phuket is extremely low. And I remember there's one of the videos that he beats a guy, and in the video that he looks at the cameraman while he's got the guy in the clinch, because he probably outweighs the guy by like 30 pounds. He's way bigger than the guy. And he's looking at the cameraman, and he's throwing the knees, and he stops the guy, and he continues to look at the cameraman, and he kisses towards the camera. And in my mind, I go, that's not the level of competition that prepares you to beat the elite guys. Now, Arslan was clearly brought in because, you know, connection with, you know, Muslim faith and being in the area. And, of course, they haven't used him for a while. I think that his body kicks can be the difference, because Sugden, who, you know, he's got that weird style. But the first thing I would think if I'm going to neutralize a guy who's playing with all that kind of movement is, oh, I'm just going to have a really strong body kick. If you play a low kick game, you're going to play into Sugden's hands. You want to do something that stops him from rocking back and forth. And I thought that, you know, that Sugden, who has gone against, you know, elite competition before, you know, meeting the K-1 champion last year, he is going to put on some entertaining moments, and he's going to have some some moments where you're like, I can't believe that didn't hit him, but he just doesn't throw with enough violence for me. Like Sugden just, it's like pop, pop, pop. And that was at 155 pounds or 154 pounds. This is at 170. So I think strength's going to come into play. I think Arslan beats him. I don't think he stops him because Sugden's really, really strange. I wouldn't be surprised if Arslan was able to land some sort of step up knee or something that in the clinch because they give him a couple of seconds. I think that he could land something in there. But man, I really think that all signs point to Arslan at least getting a decision in this one, and we'll start with you this time, Dave.
I don't know if I can agree with that. I mean, look, Sugden's still young, and he's still kind of learning. I mean, there's some upsides to him, and there's some serious downsides. You know, he trains with his dad, but, you know, like, I kind of wonder about that sometimes. Like, his dad, I hadn't seen much of him. I can't really judge him, but then from some of the stuff I've seen of Chad, he's pretty good sometimes, and then other times, I'm like, why is he at this level? He doesn't belong there. And that's frustrating, but at the same time, I feel like Arslan is kind of one of these guys who doesn't take this stuff seriously, like, at all. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, he, what else does he do? He's a professional model and a professional wrestler. Like, it's just like, I'm not seeing the commitment to the professional fighting, and everything I've seen of him has not impressed me at all. I think Sugden wins this just by the fact that he takes it a little bit more seriously and puts in the time and the effort into this. You know, and he's making a conscious effort to get out of his bubble at least. That's what I've been impressed the most about him. He had his little thing going in the UK to where he's fighting people that, you know, they're not really that great. He really hadn't gone through a list of names, although, you know, if you talk to his dad will give you 14,000 titles that Chad's held. And it's, but he's been really out there, and I think finally getting a couple of losses through K1 have kind of woken him up and maybe lit a little bit of a fire under him, although I'm not sure about the whole 170 pounds thing. He didn't really look, he looked really small for 155 too, so I still think he takes this, but, you know, it could go the other way, too.
Cool. All right, Pat, we slide to you. What are your thoughts?
I very slightly lean towards Sugden on this, just because watching Arslan, I mean, there's stuff to like there. I mean, he's got a tremendous kind of swagger about him and charisma to the way that he fights. The problem to me watching him fight is that it's all about bursts, and there's very little consistent output to the way that he works in the ring. So, you know, there are times when he starts stringing together these really nice combinations, and he gets some nice head movement going, and he really blends his defense and his offense nicely. But then there's a lot of time where he's just kind of standing there staring at you and waiting for something to happen. And, like, I think that more than anything is why I lean towards Sugden, just because I think that if anything, he's going to be consistent throughout the fight. Though with that said, the size thing is huge. Mm-hmm. Like Arslan is big for anything, and Sugden, like you guys were pointing out, is not big for 155, much less for 170. So I lean Sugden, but with some real serious reservations. And Arslan really does hit. I mean, he's got some pretty good power in his shots.
Right.
Consider this like a slight lean towards Sugden. It wouldn't surprise me either way it went. But I just think that the output and the combination striking and keeping up a high work rate is going to be enough for him.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, hey, his dad thinks that he could be a Georgia Petrosian, so there's got to be something there, right?
Well, I hope his dad thinks he can be Giorgio Petrosian. I mean, if not him, then who is?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with being ambitious and positive, you know, but like, I do think that there's always going to be, I think there are good points, and one thing that you mentioned about Arslan's consistency, I think that Jonathan Oliveira, the reason why he's able to win that fight is because of all the times that Arslan just walks himself into the corner and just lets Jonathan just throw punches. Then he goes, all right, I'm going to start to throw back at this little dude, you know, because he's a good-sized guy. So, but we'll go ahead and leave that. That's two for Sugden and one for Arslan. We move on to, which is a heavyweight bout, I guess, Justin Jacoby as he takes on Murad Buzidi. And here goes my thoughts. I can pretty much sum all my thoughts up in one Facebook picture. I was watching Justin Jacoby, who I am a fan of as a person. Dustin Jacoby, every time I talk to him, he's always a nice dude. He seems to be a promoter favorite because he's willing to take these short notice fights. And he got himself on the kickboxing match taking a short notice fight. You know, he thought that he was coming in to just get some sparring. And next thing you know, he wins the tournament and he wins $50,000. Then he starts to dedicate to kickboxing full time. Still struggles with the elite. He goes against Daniel Younga, receives every possible type of low kick combination you could take, but he's able to make a decision. He gets the really, really bad KO to Alex Pereira, and it's like he continues to look for opportunities to fight, continues to compete. He might honestly be like 1-7 in his last eight. I wouldn't be surprised if it was like that. But he shows up and he's willing to fight. But in one picture that he posted on Facebook the other day, him and his wife are in Dubai. They're like, hey, we're out in Dubai, you know, here for fights, whatever. The moment that I said, you're now going against the second hardest fighter that you've ever competed against in your life. And instead of bringing a representative who knows your skill set from your gym out there, you decided to bring your wife. Tells me that you're probably seeing this as a vacation in Dubai, where you're going to go against Barad Buzidi, and if things aren't going your way, let's go ahead and close up shop and go kick it with the missus. That doesn't spell to me that you're going to win. Now, Jacoby has the skill set in terms of he can land something in his natural ability to hurt Barad Buzidi, but bigger guys than Jacoby and actual heavyweights have trouble with Murad Buzidi. Like Gogan Saki got a decision victory over Murad Buzidi, and that's when Saki was still Saki. And Saki went into that fight trying to knock Buzidi out. So if those guys have trouble finding that shot, Dustin Jacoby, you are going to have a lot of trouble finding that shot. Murad Buzidi is better in every way, and it's crazy that I would say this, despite the fact that Jacoby's probably, 1-6 or 1-7 in his last, fights or whatever. I still prefer him fighting here than Pat Barry fighting here, because I was scared about Pat Barry coming out and fighting Murad Buzidi. I think Pat's got the right mentality about this. Pat said it after the fight that he had for the Legacy. He said, man, I realize I only got about 2-3 of these left max, and he's trying to make wise decisions on what those fights are going to be. He knows that his chin isn't as strong as it used to be when he was. This guy was the prospect in like 2002, 2003. So we're like 13 years removed from that time. So it's crazy how that works, but I am grateful that it's Jacoby against Buzidi, but I don't see that Jacoby has anything for Murad Buzidi. It's just two different classes of fighters. I'll go ahead and start with you this time, Pat.
Yeah, I got to agree with all of that. I mean, Jacoby's not bad exactly, but even by the kind of standard of understanding what his background in kickboxing is and how little experience he really has, like, it doesn't look to me like he's gotten any better over the course of his time as a kickboxer. I mean, I'm not trying to come down hard on the guy or anything like that, but he doesn't look any better now than he did 2 years ago when he beat Brian Collette the first time. He looks like pretty much the same kind of fighter, and that fighter is not good enough to beat Murad Buzidi. Even on one of Buzidi's not better days. I mean, for lack of a better way to put it, I kind of expect Jacoby to get knocked out. Knowing that he brought his wife instead of bringing like good corner people is certainly worrisome. This really seems like pretty straightforward a matchup to get Buzidi a win here.
For sure. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he didn't choose a cornerman and he paid for his wife to go out there. But I don't think I'm wrong. I think he used that plus one on his wife. And I think because he's worked at the Glory Gym or the Hemmers Gym, I think he's just going to ask Nikki to corner him. So that wouldn't surprise me. So, but I'm like, and even though, I mean, and Nikki's cornered him before, but I think that that's more of a friendship move. Or he's like, oh, Nikki's been in the game for a while. Nikki will know what to do. And Nikki will have some insight for him and so on. But there's a whole lot of difference between Nikki going off of his kickboxing knowledge as opposed to what Nikki had prepared you to do in a fight. And the team that's preparing you is the team that you're with in Colorado. So I thought that he would have chosen one of those guys. Anyways, that's neither here nor there. Who's going to win between Murad Buzidi and Dustin Jacoby, Mr. Dave Walsh?
Man, the corner thing is what gets me, because I feel like a lot of Americans end up doing this when they travel internationally. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember one of the early Glories that had Mighty Mo on it. Mighty Mo brought nobody with him. Literally nobody. Like, he had Mark Miller corner him, like, on the fly. Like, hey, you want to come corner me? Like, it's like, I've seen that happen multiple times. We need better representation. Anyway, the actual fight, look, I like Dustin Jacoby's heart. I think he's a guy that when somebody's like, well, we need a guy to fill it in, he's like, yeah, I'll do it. He's fearless, and that is very important in professional fighting. But at the same time, so maybe is knowing where to fight and where not to fight. And I think that Murad Buzidi is a beatable fighter, but he's the kind of guy who's beatable against, like, elite heavyweights. You know, I feel like Buzidi gets a bump, like, gets a really bad rap because he fought at heavyweight when he probably shouldn't have against guys who are the best of the best of the best. Yeah, of course, Badhari smoked him, that kind of stuff. Like, mm-hmm. People see that and think, oh, Buzidi gets knocked out all the time. And it's like, yeah, as long as he's fighting the best, sure, he does. But against anybody in light heavyweight, which I think this is still, like, on the cusp of that, I don't know, who knows. But because it's supposed to be heavyweight because of Pat Barry, but Buzidi fights a light heavyweight now, and so does Jacoby, I don't know, whatever. But I feel that Buzidi should easily take this just on skill level alone. I mean, he's a very skilled guy, he's very tough, and he has power, too. He just hasn't had a real good chance to demonstrate it. That being said, we've seen Murad Buzidi knocked out a ton of times, and Jacoby is a guy of some skill. He's frustrating to me because I feel like if he actually put in the time and the effort and fought guys on his own level in kickboxing, mm-hmm. he could really be good at this at some point. Instead, he's fighting guys like Murad Buzidi who have 76 wins, you know? Like, sure, he fought in the UFC before, and that's always been the why Spike wanted Glory to use him so much, but it's a bad fight for him. I hope he enjoys his vacation, though.
For sure. It's like, you know, the thing with Jonsi and Valtellini, those are glitches in the Matrix. It's really, really tough for people who don't have a lot of fights to get those kind of wins. And Wayne Barrett, he's trying to figure it out himself right now. We'll talk about him, of course, a little bit later or whatever. But, you know, it makes sense that he'll struggle to be consistent with some of these guys, even though he can pull off a win here and there. These guys have been doing it for a long time, and they've been groomed to do it. And in Holland, they've got a great system. And in England, they've got a great system. Their novice to A-class system is a great way to groom someone. Like, it's really, really... really solid, and it's going to be so tough for someone to just pick that up in the middle. And it's more than just training it. You got to find some local shows that maybe you say, hey, can I do a kickboxing match against this guy in your MMA cage? You know, you still got the same audience coming out. I'm still going to sell the same amount of tickets, but I need to kickbox. I don't think a promoter is going to be like, no, absolutely not. I think they'd be like, hey, whatever, as long as you're selling tickets. So yeah. He needs something like that if he's going to move himself in that direction. But I think he's just kind of content to try to do both, to do kickboxing here, do MMA here, and just be a prize fighter. Being a prize fighter and being good at prize fighting are different. You can definitely make a living as a prize fighter, but moving up the ranks, that's tough, even though the Glory ranking system literally has no value. We're going to go ahead and move on.
I mean, but let's go back to what you made about, like, Johnson and Valtellini. They're Canadian.
Yeah.
Canada has a really good system in place. I mean, if you look at this card, Marcus, Varga, Canadians. Mm-hmm. Canada has a way better system in place for this than anything in the United States. These guys from Canada have years of amateur fights, amateur titles and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And we don't have that, really.
For sure. Well, also, the culture of travel is really big. Like, I've been to a lot of places. You know, when I was coming up as a trainer, I've been to, you know, Holland, Thailand several times. And I cannot stress you enough that there's more people from Canada and Australia that travel the world than any other country that I could possibly think of. And it's just something in the culture. So if you're a fighter in those communities, you're going to go ahead and do what, you know, even before Simon Marcus, we can go to Clifton Brown. Clifton Brown started off this thing who said, hey, you know, I've got some fights up here, but I want to get more fights. He just goes to Thailand for a year and a half. We don't have enough Americans that do that sort of thing. And Jacoby is in need of that. Now he's married, so it's tougher, but it'd probably be better for him to just move to Holland for a year, you know, fight some guys that are B-class, and, you know, still get the A-class opportunities. But, you know, I guess that's just that is as much time as we're going to spend on the third fight on the card.
Speaking of just how hard it can be in the U.S., like one of my good buddies at my gym, a guy I've been training with since the very beginning, has decided that he wants to start, you know, fighting as an amateur. And like, we have had a hell of a time. We've spent 2 months trying to find a fight for him at his weight. He walks around, you know, 135, 140 pounds. Like, trying to find a fight for him in the greater Los Angeles area. There are 13 million people here.
Yeah.
Trying to find an amateur kickboxing match for him close to his weight. It's been hellacious. I mean, so, I mean, even if the interest is there, even if there are people who want to fight, like trying to put together the card and trying to find a promoter, like that stuff is just, I mean, it's a way bigger pain in the ass than it needs to be.
For sure. And that's one of the things, Joe Schilling, that's one of the things that made his career possible. When I interviewed him a long time ago, he said, for some reason, right when I had moved from Ohio to Los Angeles, there just happened to be all these smoker events. And he said that I fought in like 25 of them. And he was like, I was like 21-3 or something like that. That's what you need. You know, like, if you're going to make it, if you're going to beat these elite level guys, those 71 wins, the Andy Sauer wins or whatever, that's including, you know, his C-class and B-class fights too. You know what I'm saying? It's all included, you know, and that's what we need to close that gap. I'm going to go ahead. I'm actually glad we spent a lot more time on that particular fight, because the next particular fight I'm going to break down doesn't necessarily have guys that have the most extensive records. We've got Samir Bakhtiyars, I believe I'm saying it right, Bakhtiyars, and I've got Mikhail Chalik, who I was not able to find. Chalik, I should say. I wasn't able to find anything on him. You know, I couldn't get enough of footage for me to make a good assessment of his skill set. I've seen Samir fight before. He is one of the weirdest moving guys that I've ever seen in a fight. Like, he just, everything moves weird. Like, first of all, he looks like he just stands there and takes a lot of offense. And then all of a sudden, he'll just work something with a step-up knee. He'll throw a long 1-2. He'll be able to score. But he's just, literally, in one of the fights, he tried a jumping technique. And when he missed it, he fell on the ground and his face smashed on the ground. Like, literally flat. And and he just got up as if nothing happened. Like, nothing in his body suggested, I should put my hands out so I don't hit the mat. You know, he just fell on the mat like a wrestling match. And I was like, this is just weird. And he's going against, yeah, he's a really, like, it's just really, really weird. I'm telling you, you got to see that fight. Go ahead and Google his name full, and or YouTube his name full. And I think it's like the first match that comes up. And literally, he's going to try a jumping technique and miss it at the end of the round. And he's going to fall and not try to stop himself from the mat at all. And his face is going to smack off the mat. And he's going to lay there for a second and then get up. Because when he laid there, I was like, is he out? And then he got up. But this guy is going to go against Mikhail Chalik. I'm almost certain that I've seen Mikhail fight before, but I think the last name was different. Like, I think I seen him fight on Tatnef. But because I'm not 100%, I'm not going to make any assessment on it. I'm going to go ahead and say that this fight is a win for Samir, because I know just a little bit more about him than I do about Mikhail. I'm going to go ahead and kick it to you, Pat.
So I just as we were talking here, I pulled up that YouTube video I had somehow missed on my first run through, him falling flat on his face.
Oh, dude.
Yeah, that is a thing that happened. Holy crap.
Yeah, it did.
I was having to hold it back while you were talking, Steven, because Jesus, like, this is ridiculous. I mean, and this is an old video.
Oh, yeah.
So this is from like 2007 or 2008.
That's right.
I don't know about you guys. I couldn't find any, like, really anything recent on it.
Nope.
Much, no.
Like, there's some stuff, him hitting pads, you know, a year ago. A fight like 2 years ago, 3 years ago. I have to imagine, based on the fact that you can actually find stuff on him, he's the one that they want to win the fight, and that's about as deep as.
He trains at Hemmer's gym, so yeah, they probably want him to win.
Okay, yeah. So I mean, that's gonna go ahead and be my pick there, because I even tried transliterating Chalik's name into Cyrillic letters to see what I could come up with, and I still couldn't find much.
For sure. For sure. Man,
yeah. You want to see my notes for Mikhail Chalaka? Bullet point: genuinely cannot find any information or video on him. That's what I had for him. And Jim from Russia. It's so hard to be stymied like that, mm-hmm. you know. But that's, I'm stymied by that guy. I mean, at least with Samir, I've seen him face plant, and I've, you know, seen a couple of his fights from a long, long time ago, and know that he trains at a decent gym, at least with a decent trainer. You have to pick Samir, I think.
Okay, well, we'll go ahead and leave that fight as we've given it more attention than it probably deserved. We're going to go ahead and move. And I will say this as a last note on that. If you're an up-and-coming fighter and you've got a decent record, I just recommend you go to Hemmer's Gym for at least a couple weeks. Something good might happen for you. Might fool around and end up in glory. So we're going to go ahead and go to the next fight on the card, the fight that I'm most excited about on the undercard, Saulo Cavallari, as he takes on Artem Vakhadov. And, man, this fight is, if I'm running the promotion, it's the kind of fight that I want on TV, but I understand why the TV promotion wouldn't do it. But as far as, especially Cavallari, who people know, and a show that did okay ratings, they know who he is because he's the guy who won that tournament. You know what I'm saying? He got the high kick. Like you could follow him, you know, based off of some of their older events. Artem Vakhadov, really good. I think he throws power from both stances. I like how he rips to the body from both stances. I like his diversity in strikes. I hope that he doesn't play that game so much that he lets Cavallari pick up consistent offense and then be able to outpoint him. But I'm actually leaning towards Vakhadov here. I think that Cavallari really impressed me. I thought he had one of the better years in kickboxing last year, despite the fact, I mean, losing to Tyrone Spong, there's no shame in that. But I really thought that he started off good in that fight. Like, I thought Tyrone was the one who was waiting a little bit too much while Cavallari was getting off. I think Cavallari does a good job of finding the body shots. Speaking of KO win over Murat Buzidi, Cavallari has one, if I'm remembering that correctly, that right hand counter that scored like right behind the ear and just absolutely had Buzidi gone. Saulo Cavallari is got the skill set and he's got the power to really be a star in this sport for some time. Keeping him active is important, so I think this is an important fight for him. This is really a pick'em type fight as far as the athletes are concerned. I really think that both guys have a lot of skill set. It's the kind of fight that I wish was five rounds. I'm leaning towards Artem Vakhadov. I really think that he can produce more, especially in the switch stance. I like his hooks from both stances. I like that he's got the enough subtle defense to keep people from scoring on him consistently, and his movement keeps them from being able to get a hold of him. I've rarely seen Vakhadov just be, you know, low kicked into a corner or just slowed by something. He usually keeps you off balance and keeps you guessing, and I think he hides a little bit more firepower behind it than, for example, like a Artem Levin. I love Artem Levin, but sometimes I feel Artem Levin will play spar with you a little bit too much when I know he can just put some killer shots in there. Vakhadov definitely puts the kill in there. So I've got a slight lean for Vakhadov, but really this is a pick 'em for me. I'm going to go ahead and go with you, Dave Walsh. What are your thoughts?
I mean, the winner of this should be the light heavyweight champion. I mean, am I wrong here? Yeah. Like, Saki hasn't fought in a year. He's clearly fighting for other promotions and not going to come back. I mean, I Cavallari won that contenders tournament, and from what I've heard, if Vakhadov wins here, he's the contender. But I mean, if you can't get the champion, so this fight being on the Super Fight series is really weird for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, look, it wasn't supposed to be this fight initially. I can't actually remember who was originally in that spot. I would have to look it up. But it's really a strange situation. Andrei Stoico was supposed to fight there. Mm-hmm. So I kind of feel like that was going to be like, well, you know, Vakhadov gets a win over Stoica, and then maybe we build up to something later. But instead, you have two of the best at this weight class, Daniel Lunga excluded right now because Cavallari's beaten him. I think that Vakhadov probably he might be a little bit better. And I say that as a person who really likes Cavallari and thinks he's a great fighter. Vakhadov has done nothing but look super, 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 super impressive when Cavallari has looked impressive and in some places looked, like he needs a little tiny bit of work. I go with Vakatov here just for the talent level, the people he's trained with, he's a big deal in Russia, almost to the level of an Artem Levin, and it's just, there's a reason why he's that far up there, and it's because he's a super, super talented dude and probably going to be their champion in the near future.
Okay, we go to Mr. Pat Wyman.
Yeah, I too am in on Vakatov here. I like Cavallari a lot. I think that the big problem in this matchup is two problems, actually. A, the way that Cavallari lets himself get backed up to the ropes and relies on his ability to kind of fight off instead of using his footwork to get away from it in the first place. And also, I think that Cavallari is there to be hit in exchanges. His defense isn't bad exactly, but it's certainly not good. You know what I mean? Especially when he's trying to fight off the ropes, Cavallari will throw a couple of shots and kind of shell up, but he'll leave his elbows out. He'll leave an opening right down the middle if you want to crack him with an uppercut or you want to come up with a straight knee. I think there are openings there, and I think Vakatov is, he's an adaptable enough striker to find those openings and exploit them. I don't know that he'll finish Cavallari, but I think that A, the output, B, Cavallari not having a ton to offer off his back foot, and his tendency to walk himself onto the ropes, I think that's enough for Vakatov to get a win here.
Yeah,
for sure. Good stuff. And I'm telling you, one of my favorite pictures from Instagram is when Artem Levin and Vakatov are with President Putin. It just is a great picture. And they're all smiling because all the men in that country love them. They love their leader. And in that picture, they're all wearing their Russian, I think it's before the IFMAs. And for whatever reason, he was there. And literally, he takes a picture with the team, and they're just all smiles. He is, as Dave put it, he's a draw. People like him. They know who he is. He's the kind of athlete that you could build some things on. So all three in favor of Vakatov, and I'm excited about that one. I'm also excited about bringing up this next one. I'm sorry I cut you off, Dave.
Oh, no, I'm just going to say that, Vakatov holds the classification of master in sport in Russia for Muay Thai. I don't know if people understand how a 23-year-old is, this important, but he's, you said, the IFMAs, mm-hmm. it's amateur.
Yeah.
But at the same time, in Russia, that's the big deal there. They love that. There's a reason why Artem Levin, the guy who's as accomplished as he is, still competes in those from time to time.
For sure.
It's because they're a big, big deal, and that's what draws for them for some reason.
Yeah, and Russian fighters, not just in kickboxing, in MMA and in boxing as well, the way that the Russian government and the Russian people react to them has a lot to do with kind of ethno-national pride.
Mm-hmm.
And so competing for Russia in those events is a really big deal, and it brings them benefits that are not just financial. Russian fighters, when they do stuff like that and when they build up a reputation as Russian fighters, they're essentially setting themselves up for life after fighting, because they're going to get the equivalent of a pension, a cushy government job, and they will probably get an opportunity to go into politics too.
Yep.
For sure. And I think that's the way it should be in every country of the world.
But they're sportsmen.
For sure.
It's interesting that Artem Levin is moving to the United States, because that's interesting.
Maybe he's seeing, Tyrone Spong got a lot of notoriety for his move over here. But I'm definitely, I would prefer he still keep that relationship with Russia. And who knows, maybe he gets his English down and that helps him when he goes into his political career. I really think that Vakatov has got the potential to be one of the stars for the future. And like we talked about, with him being young, with Anatoly being young, that's what you want. You want young stars that have got a country behind them. So I'm definitely excited to see this performance. And who knows, Cavallari definitely has the tools to win this fight. But I definitely think that we are all on the same page and leaning Vakatov. Going to go ahead and move to what heavyweight bout. There's one reason why the bout between Chai Lewis Parry and Park Young-soo was put on this card. It's put on this card so that when I did this podcast show, I could talk about my favorite Soo Young Park story. Because, of course, anytime I think about this guy, I'm always going to think about his run in K1, And in particular, I'm going to think about the fight with Musashi, which is probably one of the most entertaining, crazy antic thing that I've ever seen inside of a K1 ring. Where in that one, Park had hurt Musashi with a groin shot. And then after Musashi recovered, he had scored another one, and it looked like Musashi wasn't going to be able to continue. So then he celebrated as if he had won when they took Musashi into the back. And he, you know, was trying to make it seem like, oh, it's his fault that he's not fighting. And they restarted the fight, and Musashi, who is not the after-fight antic person at all, knocks Young out. And after he is out, he then stands over his body and starts yelling at him several times, pushing his way so that he could start yelling down at him. It's one of the craziest things I've ever seen. That is the only reason why this fight's on the card, so that I can tell you that story in case you guys didn't see it. This fight is not what I would consider glory level as far as accomplishments are concerned.
This is terrible.
But I do think that Chai Lewis Parry has, you know, I believe undefeated in boxing and MMA, if I'm remembering correctly. I could be wrong there. But he's coming into this. He's a tall guy. England's got, you know, a fan base that they want to use. And if you're going to give a guy their first fight and you want to try to sell them down the road, Park's a guy I'd bring in. Park Young is a ideal guy to come in and be that serviceable role as fodder for, you know, Chai Lewis Parry. I mean, it's just, I look at his fights, I can't tell you anything about his skill set that I feel confident in. All I saw from Lewis Parry, who actually went against a kickboxer in Alan, I forget how to pronounce his last name, but that African-based dude that was in China, and he's like really short, one with low kicks a lot, always lost to elite level guys. But that was one of his MMA fights. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to watch this fight, and these two are going to be in a stand-up war because, you know, both of them kickbox a little bit, and that's going to give me a little bit of insight on Parry. Only thing that happened was Parry, because he's so long, the African dude tried a high kick, didn't really get anything. He closed the distance, and he threw a lot of shots to the shorter guy, and then that guy went for a takedown, and then the fight ended on the ground where Parry got a reversal, and then he stopped him. But that wasn't enough to tell me about how he's going to kickbox. The only thing I need to know about his kickboxing is that he's going against Soo Young Park. So that tells me enough that he's got the chance to come in and win by KO in this heavyweight bout. I'm going to go ahead and start with Pat. Pat, you were telling me via email that this is your favorite fight of the card. What are your thoughts?
I've actually had my eye on Parry for a while now, just as an MMA prospect, because you know, there are so few heavyweights out there in general that, like, whenever a guy comes along, I feel like I got to pay some sort of attention to him. And, you know, he's got some talent. You know, mm-hmm. he's huge, first and foremost.
Yes.
I think he's 6'9". Like, the dude is ridiculously big. And he moves well. He moves like he's actually put together. He's not some lumbering, he lumbers because he's 6'9", and I think pretty much everybody who's 6'9" lumbers. Yes. But less than most guys who are 6'9", Parry doesn't really lumber like that. He's coordinated. He's got good physical tools. He's fast. He does some interesting things in his MMA fights from what I've seen in terms of like Superman punches, and he looks like to me it looks like he's got pretty decent fundamentals in terms of the way that he puts his shots together, stays over his feet while he's throwing. So I think all of that is better. Is a roundabout way of saying he's better than Park Young-soo. So take that as you will. I expect him to finish this, but I don't think there's any way he doesn't.
For sure, definitely kick it over to you, Dave. Are you in the same boat? Because clearly, like I said, I just didn't see kickboxing skill set in what Parry did, but I didn't think that, you know, no way did I mean to imply that he's unskilled, but when I think of kickboxing skill set, I say, if you were to fight 100 kickboxing rounds, what would it look like? I still thought that he threw with competence. I just didn't see enough in those fights to be like, oh yeah, this is the guy. So as the dogs boo me in the background there, Dave Walsh, what are your thoughts on this epic super fight?
Here's the thing, though. Like, Parry's 31 years old, and he's getting into this. You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't really make sense to me. But at the same time, Young-soo's 40, and Glory has really kind of papered his record at 3-8. He's not 3-8. He's like 3-20-something. You know, like he's. Oh God. I mean, he's clearly brought in to lose, and that's what he's gonna do. He's gonna lose. You know. I don't see any of that going any other way. This is a terrible fight.
Hey, vacation in Dubai. It's all the rage. So,
I guess so.
So we'll go ahead, and there's a boxing match that I talked off air that we are not going to talk about because we do kickboxing on this show, baby. This is about the kickboxing world. We're going to go ahead and get into the main card, live on TV, as it says, the four-man tournament. We've got two title fights. I'm actually pretty excited. I think the, like I said, and like Pat said, all in all, it's a solid card, and it's going to, and I think the glory cards have done a good job of being solid top to bottom. I really do think that when I look at the whole glory card, I say, all right, there are some really good athletes and some really good fighters with good resumes, young up-and-comers that they are getting on the promotion. I just think that the next step for them is how do they show us those guys so that we can follow them consistently. Right now, the guys that they're using on the main card stay consistent. You know, they use 90% of the main card as guys that you already know. If you're gonna grow the brand, you're gonna have to have some of these up and comers get that opportunity. In particular, you got to have a guy like Vakhadov, who has fought for your promotion. I want to say three times and won three times, and I don't think he's been on TV one time. So, you got to get those kind of opportunities there. But we'll go ahead and jump into the tournament. They call it the tournament contenders. This one, we're going to go with Jason Wilnes as he takes on Alex Pereira. I am a big fan of both guys, and I thought Alex had one of the better burst on the scene type years last year. Of course, he had the big KO over Jacoby, but then of course to win the tournament over a very seasoned guy in Sahak Baparian. Sahak, of course, the reason why Sahak wasn't at his best going into that fight is because Jason Wilnes gave him hell in the fight before. Like, he really had to earn that early round fight, and that's what tournaments are. Part of it is just the attrition of figuring out how to get through all these guys, which is why back in the early 2000s, you would see guys really come out with a strong focus on scoring KOs with their hands, and they would go for it for at least round and a half, and after that, they go, okay, let me go ahead and go back to my kickboxing skill set if they weren't able to do it. And the reason why is they're trying to win a tournament. Wilnes gave Sahak Baparian so much trouble in that first round that he came in and he gave good effort, but Alex Pereira was a step ahead of him, scored it down in the first round of that bout, and I think that it showed good. Both guys have success against the same level of guy, and Sahak Baparian is one of the better guys, and I think in the weight class. As I was playing with this in my head, and I thought Jason Wilnes was really put together. Barrett, I believe, was his last win against Wayne Barrett, if I'm remembering that correctly. I can't remember the date, but Wilnes has kind of gotten himself on a little bit of a stride. He stands strong in the pocket. He's willing to exchange. He throws hard and he throws clean. He looks for his low kick counters. I always felt that he can walk around kind of like earmuffed up and just let people get off so that he can look to go after them sometimes. And I think that there's just enough slickness in Alex in terms of sometimes Alex moves like a boxer in the way that he can score and the way that he looks for his hooks and the way that he moves. I wanted to go with the consistent work of Wilnes. I really did. But I do think that Alex Pierre is going to have just a little bit more. I feel that he's going to be able to outscore him in the cards. I wouldn't be surprised if he scored it down in this one. I'm not expecting it more than anything. I just think that the movement's going to be a little bit too much trouble, and I think that he's going to outscore Wilnes. Going to go ahead and start with you this time, Pat, if I'm remembering this correctly. I think it's Dave's turn. Going to start with you this time, Dave. Who you got, Wilnes and Alex?
I have Pereira. I mean, pretty handily. I mean, I like Wilnes okay. But something about him just screams unremarkable to me. Like, I feel like he's going to be a player in the division for a while to come, but I feel like he's going to kind of be like Irwin Jaishara was in the K-1 heavyweight field, where he's a guy capable of getting wins, but then when it comes to going up against the top guys, he kind of falls short in the end. And he might have a surprise win here or there, but a solid hand, but might not reach that top level. I mean, yeah, of course he had some success in the past. You know, he held the Showtime 85 kg belt and whatever. But Pereira's been really impressive of late. Losing to Artem Levin is not anything to be ashamed of, and he's still young. He's still got a lot of ways to go, and that's I think he's going to do fine here.
Pat.
So I'm really interested in this fight, especially because, you know, the first time they fought, Pereira came out and just blasted him in the first round and pretty easily won the first round. But he also did nothing to stop Wilnis's low-kicking game or his body-punching game.
Mm-hmm.
And so pretty clearly, just over the course of that, the first 4.5 minutes of that fight, Wilnis wore him down with the low kicks and with the body punches, and eventually dropped him a couple of times. And that was that. And there was something really bizarre that happened. Like, the lights in the venue went out, like as Wilnis knocked Pereira down, and it was very strange. It was a very strange fight. But like, since then, I really think Pereira has made more improvements to his game, and we haven't seen Pereira get, like, just blasted with low kicks like that since that fight. Like, I think he learned some important things from it. Like, low kicks are always going to be a problem for Pereira just because of the way that he fights and his stance and the way that he moves and the way that his defense works. But he just can't get hit with as many as he got hit with the first time that Wilnis fought him, and I don't think he will. I really like Pereira's game. I like the way that he puts his combinations together. He's really long. When he gets you backed up to the ropes, like, Pereira is a terrifying dude. And so I kind of think that as long as he can check some of those kicks, as long as he can pull himself out of range, keep his jab pumping, I think that he should win this fairly handily.
Yeah, I mean, he was a boxer initially, and that's, I think that's a lot of what you saw in that first fight against Wilnis back, what was that? That was 2012, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's been 3 years, and for the guys being as young as they are, they both have a chance to grow, and I feel like Pereira might have grown a little bit more.
For sure, for sure. And it's just, I think the biggest key is, you use the term grow, I think we know who Wilnis is. I think he's going to be who he is in every fight, whereas I think Pierre can show us something new as we move forward. So definitely good stuff there, and we'll go ahead and slide to the next fight. Next fight on the card, we got Simon Marcus as he takes on Wayne Barrett. I've said this about Simon Marcus before. I've got one big problem with Simon Marcus. He doesn't have defense. What I mean by he doesn't have defense is there is no hands come up to block shots. He is so used to getting into the clinch and neutralizing people's offense that the kickboxing skill set, he rarely looks to use a guard. He'll either lean out of the way or he'll try to walk backwards until you finish striking. When he throws hands, despite the fact that his shoulders are very square, he's a powerful dude. Like, he is, he looks the part. I'll never forget the first time I actually seen him. It was when I was in Jamaica and the Champions vs. Champions 2. And he was there, and he was working with Clifton Brown in the back there doing clinch stuff. And at the time, I had no idea that, you know, he was going to be the, you know, next, you know, the guy down the road. And, of course, he put together a really good resume. His gym, Simon One's got a good connection with fights in China, so he still goes out there and fights on a regular basis. But even in those fights, the signs were there well before he got stopped by Schilling, thank you. Right before he, before that, he was in a tournament in China, I want to say earlier in that year, and he was dropped, and he came back and he won, and then in the next fight, he was dropped again, and he came back and he won. And I was like, okay, well, he's got the grit and he's got the heart, but sometimes when he's reaching out for the clinch, he's open for everything, and guys are finding him there. Wayne Barrett can find him. Like, Barrett has got all the athleticism. He's got all the skill. He's got all the fast twitch to take advantage of those. The only thing is, can Marcus adopt some sort of combination low kick style? Because Barrett waits for people to finish offense, too. He usually blocks, or his defense is moving away. And that's, I'm used to seeing that, because in MMA, that's how most people get away from strikes. Most people in MMA don't use a guard. They get out with their feet, and that's why a lot of KOs and stuff like that happen. It's because you're not used to blocking. You're used to getting away from shots. And I think that Barrett, because he's used to being a really good athlete, he's usually just getting away with his feet. You're going to meet a level of guy where you're going to have trouble with that. So Barrett's always going to struggle with a guy like Wilnis or Pierre or, you know, Artem Levin. You know, it just gets worse, you know. So, like, I actually lean for Wayne Barrett to outscore Simon Marcus, but Simon Marcus can definitely win this fight because he can score with the big shots, but if he just has a consistent low kick game, something consistent with his game, whether it's consistent body kick or consistent low kick, he'll be able to score on Barrett. But if he goes out there, starts winging, bites down. Like when there was a moment where he backed Schilling into the corner and he just threw big shots until he dropped Schilling. Yeah. He won't be able to do that with Barrett. Barrett moves too well. If he is able to do that, he can score the shot. Like Marcus has got the tools, but I just think the slickness of Barrett's going to be the difference here. I'm going to go ahead and go to you, Pat. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I got to echo that. Like, it's hard not to look at Marcus's game and see the openings for a guy who's got really good timing and who's really fast to just counterpunch the hell out of him as he comes forward. That's what Barrett's really good at. I mean, especially because you look at it in terms of, like, this is a matchup of a circular fighter versus a linear fighter. Marcus is very linear in terms of the way that he moves in the ring, and Barrett is a quintessentially circular fighter. I mean, he's an out fighter. He wants to be out in the middle where he's got all the room in the world to use space as his defense. And so they're basically, to me, that says that there are two real outcomes here. Either Marcus eats heavy leather as he's on his way in, reaching for the clinch, or he manages to repeatedly back Barrett up to the ropes and kind of work on him in the clinch, land short punches. And honestly, the former seems so much more likely to me just because we've seen Marcus get face planted in numerous fights as he's walking forward. And Barrett's got real power. He's really light on his feet. He does a good job, for the most part, of maintaining distance. Like, I like the way that he finishes combinations with front kicks. I think that's... he's really good at that. He's good at maintaining distance. And you've got to be really excellent to walk him down and take his space away and then pin him there. And I'm just not sure that Marcus can do that without getting hit over and over and over again. And if Barrett hits Marcus, 10 or 15 times coming in, one of those is going to drop him. So I like Barrett by knockout here.
Dave?
I feel like ragging on Simon Marcus is so, like almost like taboo because he did so well in Muay Thai for so long. I mean, wins over Schilling, win over Levin. Like, this guy, he's got some serious, beating Artem Bakatov. Like, he's done amazing things.
For sure. Oh, and to his credit, quick interruption, if this was full rules Muay Thai, I'd take him over everybody in the field.
Exactly. Oh, absolutely. But it's not. That's the problem. Him in kickboxing rules, he just does it. Doesn't it never? It's not going to work. He's had success in Kunlun, sure, but like you said, it involves getting hurt all the time. And the last time we saw him over in China was the end of January, and he got dropped like four times or something that. Like it was ugly. Terrible. And then he tries to show off that he's not hurt by doing push-ups. It's like, come on, dude, get over it. Like you're. It was embarrassing considering I know nothing about Fang Bian, the guy that beat him. Not nothing, but minimal stuff here to beat a guy on his caliber of his caliber. I just think that Barrett has shown a little bit more of an aptitude for actual kickboxing, and he's still a developing talent, which is exciting. I mean, we've seen newer things from him. Like, sure, he's like 28 or something like that. He's still developing though, and it's interesting to watch him. I mean, he's had some upsets. The win over Schilling was pretty crazy. Mm-hmm. The win over Stoic was good. Sure, he lost to Schilling a second time, but that was a really, really close fight.
I thought he won.
Ah, me too. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then the wellness fight was pretty close too. So I just see him taking this, and it's just that Marcus is not equipped for kickboxing at this level.
Cool. Well, let's go ahead and wrap our tournaments up. All of us have Wayne Barrett going against Alex Pereira. This I don't have to take a lot of time with. Because Alex is a good enough athlete to close the distance, he just has more kickboxing skill set. Not impossible for Wayne Barrett to win. Not impossible. Not saying that at all. But if you say who is the most consistent, and one of my favorite things about Alex Pereira is since his last Glory fight, he's been fighting on smaller promotions, so he has been getting the fights. He has been consistent. Even if they're just one every 90 days, that's better than waiting for your next Glory opportunity. You got to keep competing. And if the opportunity is there for you to compete, you got to take it. So he's been continuing with that, whereas Wayne Barrett has started a GoFundMe where he can get someone to help support him as he trains. And it's just that's actually pretty common right now. A lot of people are doing that sort of thing. Yeah. But, it just shows that, man, if he had a couple of fights here and there, I think he'd take them. You know what I'm saying? Let me get better. Let me get better in my craft so that I'm going against these elite-level guys. And I just think that he is always going to have trouble. Any American's always going to have trouble closing that gap. So I don't think he gets stopped or anything like that. But I definitely think that it's an easy decision for Alex Pereira. What are your thoughts, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, Alex takes this. There's no doubt in my mind about that. I think that Wayne's good, but just like you said, he's not competing enough to he's treating it like he's fighting in the UFC and that, you know, you just wait for Daddy Dana to call me up and give me a fight. Mm-hmm. And that's not how kickboxing works. Since the last time that we've seen Pereira in a glory ring, which was at 17, he fought Robert Thomas and Ivan Gallez in WGP in Brazil. He's keeping active, and he's done this before too. So I'm just like, that, you know, here's a guy who's committed to what he's doing on a high level, and he's improving all the time. The win over, if you want to look at, like, rankings and, you know, who beat who or whatever, win over Robert Thomas is a damn good, it's a fine win, you know? Like, it's a good way to rebound after losing to Artem Levin. I just, if Alex Pereira ends up in the finals of this, Alex Pereira beats Wayne Barrett, and it's no fault of Wayne Barrett's other than maybe not having the right experience.
Pat?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to think that Pereira would be a really difficult stylistic matchup for Barrett at any point in time, just because Barrett relies so much on sliding in and out of range, and Pereira's length and his ability to kind of cut you off with that long left hook he likes and really kind of really tight footwork, I think is always going to be a problem for a guy like Barrett. I lean towards him in this. I think that he will. I think that if this fight goes down, I think he'll back Barrett up to the ropes, land some good hard shots on him, drop him a time or two the way that Wilnis did.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and jump. Everybody had the tournaments the same with Alex taking it all. We're going to go ahead and get to the title fights. Featherweight world title fight on the line as we get Gabriel Varga and as he takes on Mousab Amirani. First of all, this is weird for me because Yuta Kubo was the champion. He never lost it. Masaki Nori beat him later that year. So if you make an argument, like if you want to play the, follow the losses game, if you will. After Masaki Nori lost that fight, 4 months later, Masaki Nori beat him. And then Masaki Nori has been consistently fighting in Japan at 65 kgs. And then they do a tournament for K1, and Yuta Kubo's in the tournament, and he shows up wearing this title from Glory, which is just absolutely hilarious for him to have in the K1 tournament. So that's the last I ever saw of their title. If anything, Ku Fairtech should be the actual champion. This fight, first of all, Mousab Amirani, who was able to beat Yuta Kubo later. He beat him in a fight that wasn't for a title, later. Mousab Amirani, stylistically, is the fighter that any promoter in the world would love to have as your champion. He is a guy who's going to get in there, he's going to let his hands go, combinations and kicks, he's going to throw with big shots, and then he's going to take a break. And whenever he takes a break, everybody else is going to get off of him offensively, and then he's going to fire back. But he uses so much explosion that I wonder if he could sustain that for a 5-round fight. The last time that he was in a 5-round fight that I could think of that was of note was the fight with Anawat. And in the Anawat fight, though I thought that he was probably winning because he's winning the kickboxing portion of it. Anawat, I've said it before, Anawat, Bovi, those style of guys are some of the more beatable ties because they fight like Westerners. It's the guys that are like, Pecorn, the guys who play the game, Sanchai, the guys who are slick, those are the guys that the rest of the world struggle with. Amirani got up on Anawat, and we're talking, this has got to be like 7 years ago now. He got up on him on the cards, and he caused a cut, and he was able to win that fight. And since then, he's been in some all-action battles, but those have been 3-rounders in kickboxing. Can he sustain that for 5 rounds? Enter Gabriel Varga, who's very, very slick. He's got a good combination style. He's got a good style for kickboxing that translated over from his, full rules Muay Thai that a lot of the Canadians, deal with as they are in the amateur system and so on. I was really having a tough time picking this one. I really wanted to pick the slicker Varga. I really wanted to do it. But I just think that Amirani's got the skill set and the power to score something to drop Varga at some period of time. And I think that that's going to be the difference. I think that Varga is definitely going to be game. He's going to move forward. He's going to have some good moments. But, man, I really, really like Mousab Amirani. I just think that You know, he's gone against more elite competition his whole life. And Varga and the other Canadian, you know, fighters have done a good job in their, you know, brief moments, you know, of competing. They've done a good job of beating elite guys without having the most experience to back up. But I really like, you know, Masab Rani, and I think that he wins it. I think the crowd's going to go crazy when he wins it because he's got the kind of style that you want to see. Going to go ahead and start with you, Pat. What are your thoughts?
See, I see what you're saying, but I have to go with Varga here just because of the consistent output. Mm-hmm. I think that we've seen this from Varga before, where he's fighting somebody who has that pattern of explosion and then resting. And what Varga does when you're resting is hit you. That he's always going to be on you. He's always going to have his combinations going. He's always going to be scoring. Whether that's with his usual kind of bread and butter fare, you know, punch kick combinations, or whether it's with the flashier stuff when you give him some space to work out in the middle. And I don't think that, like, where we've seen Varga struggle is when you take away his space and when you back him up to the ropes or corner him, which is not necessarily easy to do. But when Varga has space to operate, because he's fairly long, and because of the way that he kind of extends his shots, he's hard to deal with out in the middle. And I think that if Amrani tries to fight him there, then he's going to get buried under Varga's work rate. I don't disagree that Amrani is going to be the much, much harder puncher here. He's got much more potential to finish the fight. But I think that over five rounds, when you look at what Amrani's done in those kinds of fights before, I think that to me it's Varga. I think the issue of output is just too big for me to overlook.
For sure, you know, and I was definitely torn. You know, one thing with Varga that I also like that he does is Amrani has never been a guy to check a lot of low kicks. Ever. And I know that Varga, he's got a good combination flow. And I remember in his fight with Banui, Amrani, I was there in France in Lyon when they had that fight. And Amrani didn't answer the third because he took so many low kicks. He was trying to play the explosion game so much, but he took a lot of low kicks. And that was the difference there. So definitely, I mean, it's just going to be tough. I'm going to go ahead and kick it over to you, Dave. Let's not forget, the Masato factor comes into play here. Every time Amrani scores something or throws something big, crowd's going to be cheering. What are your thoughts, Dave?
I can't pick against Amrani here. I just can't. It's just the explosive factor is just too much to factor in here. I think that Varga's a good, you know, he's a good, talented dude. He's very consistent. He's kind of machine-like in some ways. But at the same time, I'm not sure that he'll be able to hold up to the pressure that Amrani's going to put on him. I just think that everything that Varga does, to me, just kind of screams Amrani is going to, you know, deal with it and then give it back 10 times more. I think it's totally, entirely possible that Varga outpoints him and is able to keep him at bay, but I think it's going to be, I don't know, I just don't see, Amrani is always... My dogs are in a terrible mood today. He's always really aggressive. And I think, you know, if even one time out of 10, the aggression works and he starts landing, that's all he really needs.
Okay, so we'll go ahead and go to the last fight on the card. Lightweight title is on the line here as we talk about Robin Van Roosmalen as he takes on Andy Risty. As I kept playing this fight out in my head over and over and over, and I go back to the time that they fought the first time, where Andy Risty, as I describe it, in his reign of terror on his way to the title, the two biggest victims were the number one and two fighters in the world, and Petrosian and Van Roosmalen. In my mind, I always ask myself, man, if these guys were to fight 100 rounds, who did I think would win the majority of those rounds? And I always pick Robin Van Roosmalen. I think his natural ability to score will give him that opportunity. But whenever I choose the 100 rounds scenario, I always eliminate the ability to stop a guy, to hit a guy, to hurt a guy. And if there's one thing that Andy Risty's got, it's the ability to kill a man. And as I was playing with this one back and forth, I kept saying to myself, I think Roosmalen can win a 5-round decision, but I think Andy Risty can stop him before that. And that's my thing. Do I go with the stoppage or do I go with the kickboxing acumen? I'm going to go with the stoppage. I think that Risty is... who can still win rounds. He's not incapable of winning rounds. But because of Rus Malin's height, with the step-up knees, with the way that he plays with, and it's a very Lucien Corbin. It's weird that him and Lucien didn't work out because the things that Andy Risty does are so much Lucien Corbin in style. The same, the whole thing with knees, the same side striking, that's something that Lucien plays with so much. And Andy Risty is really good at that, at hiding big punches and big knees behind subtle hand movements. And not in the way you think. It's easy to go left hook to right knee or left hook to low kick. Like, that's something that's really, really common. But can you go left hook to your switch knee? Like, it's really, really, really subtle. Or knee to your hooks. Like, that is something that Andy Risty plays with so well. And it's off of the path that Rus Malin is used to. And I look at some of the fights where Rus Malin has lost, Muhammad Kamal, for example. In those fights, the guys were just a little bit different rhythm than he thought, you know. And Rus Malin can play a kickboxing game straight up in front of you. But Muhammad Kamal can play a kickboxing game right in front of you. But in that particular fight, he was able to move just enough and keep the flow from being back and forth kickboxing. And that was the difference. Zavik Kiria just... outside of being able to score a down here and there, I never thought that he was an elite kickboxer in terms of his ability to consistently win rounds against elite guys. The moment he won the title, I was like, they're going to make Rus Malin the next fight, the title challenger, and Rus Malin's going to win for a third time, and he was able to do it. In this fight, I really think that Rus Malin will struggle with a guy who doesn't play combinations kick with him. And I think Risty is going to be able to score. Even if it goes to a decision, at some period of time during the fight, he would have scored a down or two. I think Andy Risty will once again be the glory lightweight champion of the world. Dave Walsh, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, Andy Risty takes this. I mean, all respect to Van Rus Malin. He's a skilled guy. He throws together these exciting combinations, all that kind of great stuff. But at the same time, Risty is just so good at getting down, you know, his opponent's rhythm. He's so good at breaking it. He's so good at putting together his own kind of, like, unique combinations. And like you said, the way that he mixes in his knees and stuff like that. And just, he comes from different angles. I mean, let's not forget, this is the guy who beat Georgia Petrosian and did so in incredibly convincing fashion. Not mm-hmm. just lucky like a lucky strike. He did it in a way that made Petrosian look mortal. Mm-hmm. I've never been a huge Andy Risty fan, but I'm willing to sing all of these praises for this guy. That says a ton about him. I think that Risty takes this, not taking away anything from Robin. Just, yeah, Risty.
Finish it off with you, Pat.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to agree with that. I think that it's hard for me to imagine a worse stylistic matchup for Van Rus Malin than Risty, just because... you know, for the most part, Van Rus Malin can get away with being pretty small for the division in terms of, not so much in terms of like the thick, like his thickness or strength or anything like that, but he's so short and his arms are so short that the range that Van Rus Malin likes to operate at is to get his punch kick combinations off is exactly the range where Risty can get his knees going. And Risty's ability to snake shots around, under, through your guard is some of the best that I've ever seen. And Van Rus Malin is there to be hit. I mean, he's going to shell up, and it may not be easy, but he's going to be at the range where he can be hit for extended periods of time in any fight. And especially so with Risty, because of Risty's length, that it just opens up infinitely more opportunities to land that big shot. I mean, so... it would not at all surprise me if Van Rus Malin were up on the cards whenever the fight ended, but I expect a stoppage here. I think either a knee kind of through the guard, or like a left hook around it, something like that. Either a looping shot around the guard or a knee coming straight up, I think is going to finish him off.
Cool. Well, that is our glory breakdown, everyone. If I'm remembering this correctly, it's going to play earlier in the day on Friday, and it's going to be on TV in the U.S. at 8 p.m., if I'm thinking that.
It's at 10 p.m. Eastern, at least.
10 p.m.
Yeah, so it's playing a little bit later, because I know live, like the Super Fight series, starts at 10:30, and then the actual show itself starts, I don't know, 2 hours after that, I think.
Yeah, so, and that's in the day for us Friday here in the States.
Yeah, although we can't watch the Super Fight series, but we can't watch Glory 20.
Yeah, well,
because it's geo-blocked.
One of the things that hurt the Saki and Tyrone thing was everybody had heard about the leg break and probably saw a video of it before the fight card actually, you know, played later that day. So, you know, definitely for those who are big, you know, into and liverkick.com will usually give you the ratings breakdown or whatever. Expect struggles anytime the card is played earlier in the day. Anytime people know what they're going to see, you know.
Well, to be fair, their biggest rating ever was the Tokyo card with Valtellini and Tolskin.
For sure, for sure.
Which was weird because it was, you know, played early. It was on tape delay. But then, yeah, the Turkey card just bombed.
Okay. So, and then you two will both be doing Twitter breakdowns of that, correct? While you're watching that card, the night one?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, probably. I may catch it later. It depends on what time I get home from Muay Thai.
Well, for sure. Well, I'm in the same boat. I'm cornering one of my fighters is fighting Daniel Pineda in Legacy this week. So, like, got a normally off Friday. I'll be working this Friday. So, but thanks everybody for listening. Thanks for listening to the podcast show. One more time, Dave Walsh, where can they find you on Twitter?
At Liverkick, DOTCOM, more than my personal stuff, at DVEWLSH, because I don't like the A's.
Exactly. And then, Pat.
You can find me at Patrick_Wyman or on SureDog.com.
Cool. And you can find me, Stephen the Warman. Thank you very much. Thanks for all the support. And again, I got some extra messages lately about, you know, the success of two of my fighters, Johnny Hendrickson, Jared Rolschult. I appreciate those kind words. And definitely thanks to all the people who've been supporting kickboxing, pushing the sport forward. Thanks for these two fine gentlemen coming on and talking kickboxing with me for an hour and a half. So thanks, everybody, and have a good one. Peace.